Okay, so good to see everybody. This is the end of the five-part series that we had. We're back to normal. We're back to our Monday night class that we are having together. Does anyone remember what we learned on Monday nights? It's been so long.
Topics.
Topics, right. So I try what we try to do is contemporary issues, just a reminder, refresher. And what that means is usually every night, every Monday evening, we try to do another topic, which is a major contemporary issue. I bet, I know we talked about placing bets this past Wednesday night. For those who were there for that class, I just covered the Wednesday night class. So you can figure out from there if it's mutter to take a bet, but you can take bets on how long it'll take us to get through all the major contemporary issues. At some point, we run out of like the big popular topics, but I wanted to share with everyone that starting in January, this year will be continuing. But what I'm trying to do is rather than do a random topic each and every night, it still will be like that. There will be something new, it will be a new topic. But I want to take a focus on specific poskim, specific leaders, such as Ramosha Feinstein, Ramosha Sternbach, Rav Nachum Rabinovich. And if some of these names don't ring a bell, that's good. I want to talk about the leading poskim of the 20th and 21st century, and really delve into what their important policies and halachic decisions that they made that really affect the way we live today. So this will be within the broader context of our contemporary issues. All the response will be studying our contemporary issues, but the idea is that we're going to take a few weeks each on a different personality. And we'll start with Rav Moshe Sternbach, who's the head of the Eidah Haredit, is the head of basically the Haredim in Yerushalayim. He's a big name. And we'll move on to some other poskim as well. But this year we'll be continuing otherwise as normal. Anyway, I have a very casual topic for this evening. This evening we'll be talking about women's ordination. Should women be ordained? Should women become rabbis? This has been a controversy for quite a while. And I'm not really sure if the controversy has been resolved yet. But as usual, I think this topic is one that we come into with a little bit more opinions. So as usual, I think we're a pretty easygoing group. We have our opinions coming in, but we always have respectful dialogue. We always have insightful questions. So the same way we do it for any other topic, it shouldn't be any different for when we talk about this discussion about whether women should be ordained. And that entire controversy. So my goal in this class is always is to be descriptive as opposed to prescriptive. What I want to try to do is to outline the debates on both sides to the best of my ability and succinctly. And then maybe at the end, I'll give you a little bit of my own opinion in there as well. But I'll try not to weigh in too deeply with my own personal opinion, which I'm sure you'll figure out based on my religious affiliations. But anyway, I think the most important thing we could do with any major topic, as always, is look at the sources and see where the sources guide us. So it's possible my reading of the sources will be different than your reading of the sources. And that's why I bring the topic here. So that way, I'm not only bringing the source to you, but maybe you'll give me something that I didn't think of when I learned the topic. Okay, any questions before we jump in? Well, of course not. We haven't seen any sources yet. Good. That was a test.
Well,
All
Rabbi,
right.
actually, I'm sorry, I signed on a couple of minutes late. What is the topic tonight?
Right here, you see on the screen?
Oh,
Female
that is
rabbis,
the
may women
that
serve?
is the topic for tonight. Okay, great.
Yes, female rabbis, may women serve in a position of rabbinic authority. This is not the Rav Sternbach series yet because that wasn't even dessert. He wouldn't even consider that in a tshuva. That wouldn't even be a tshuva for Ramosha Sternbach. It's not even a question. So, okay. So what we're going to do is like any topic, we have to ask ourselves, well, this is something that Rav Ezra Schwartz, our scholar in residence that we had a few weeks ago. Yeah, a few weeks ago, I think, at this point. So Rav Ezra Schwartz, when I was learning in his shiur for 1 year in YU, he would always say, he'd make these jokes such as, you know what the difference is between how yeshivish people approach Judaism and how modern Orthodox people approach Judaism? Modern Orthodox people assume things are mutter until proven aser. The Yeshivish people, they think everything's aser until proven mutter. Everything's prohibited until proven permissible. So I'm going to take the modern orthodox approach here and assume that everything is permissible until proven impermissible. So the question is, okay, so if a woman wants to serve in a position of the rabbinate, what's to stop her from doing it the same way she does anything else? If she wants to be a doctor, she wants to be a lawyer. Well, as we'll see, it's possible the issue is not limited to rabbinate, but might even be a little bit broader than that. By the way, the reason I bring this up is not just randomly, but it's been on my mind because in current events, there was this an op-ed published in the Wall Street Journal recently. It was more of a hit piece, really, but it brought up some discussion. Basically, I forgot who wrote it. I don't know if he's really anyone of note. He said that Dr. Jill Biden should drop the doctorate mm-hmm. in her name because it's not an MD, it's a doctorate of education. So that's what he's saying. That many people who are more of a progressive bent, they said that's sexism. You're saying that she can't be a doctor because she's a woman, or you're basically taking down a doctorate in a very woman-dominated field. Why are you choosing to target that? So I don't really want to get into that particular debate. I think there's a lot of mudslinging going on there, and it's really just about scoring political points. That's what it sounded like to me. But it got me thinking about the question of titles and of authority in the religious sphere as well. So I just wanted to bring to people's attention, this isn't just a random topic, but perhaps it could also inform our thinking about society around us as well. So here we go. This is the locus classicus, the go-to source right at the beginning of the discussion. If I were to ask you, actually, you know what? Why am I telling this? Let me stop the screen share for one moment. Before I start outlining in the sources what the potential issues are with a woman serving as a rabbi, maybe I can ask all of you what you think potential issues might be going into this. Even, I understand, many of us might already feel that women should be rabbis, and that's our opinion. We're gung-ho about that. Okay. But for a moment, let's put ourselves in the shoes of the people who think that it is usur, that's prohibited. What kind of arguments do you think could be made to say that a woman may not serve as a rabbi from that perspective?
Well, some of the reasons may be the same as why women are not included or can't do lots of things like, you know, most of the mitzvot. A woman can't be a witness. And if, you know, in the Talmud, there were many times when a woman or a deaf or a child or, you know, various other and sundry types of people are not included, and women is one of them, almost always.
Okay, well, but you don't see other professions where they get excluded, though. I understand they can't serve, let's say, as a witness, fine. But, you know, it's very odd. You don't really see professional exclusions. So why this as a profession is that being barred? What would be a reason to prohibit that? And were you going to say something?
You don't see them in professional exclusion. You mean halachically there aren't professional?
Yeah, if a woman wants to be a baker, if a woman wants to, Shochet, right. That is part of the discussion, but that's very good. That's the whole debate, right? Right at the beginning of your day. So when we say akol shochet, then anyone is able to shecht. But then Ashkenazi custom is that women are not shochtim, they don't slaughter. So that's part of the discussion, Phyllis. Very good. But
well, I think that if back in the day when, you know, all these halachas were being written and, you know, all that, if any women thought about becoming bankers or lawyers or anything like that, they would have come up with a reason why they can't. But it wasn't dealt with. So, you know, now you're coming to, you know, the 20th century, and there's simply nothing that you can look to that says you can't do it because nobody even conceived of it as something somebody would want to do. I mean, it's a funny conundrum.
So I like the point, Toby, you're making, and this, God willing, to be a future class when we talk about mechitzas. So it's the early conservative movement, for instance, when they made their whole argument about not having mechitzas, the reason is because mechitzas just never really existed in shul because women either never attended shul or if they intended shul, they're basically like in a separate room on a separate floor in a balcony ensconced away. So the whole question about how tall should mechitza be in shul, should be down the middle, should be to the side, you don't see that in earlier literature, because similar to what you're describing, Toby, it was never a havamina. It never occurred to them. So you're right. Nowadays, that women are occupying, basically can occupy any other profession in the world. So why is it that clergy seems to have not been open to them? Just one moment, Phyllis. But other than sociological reasons, can we think of a halachic reason that might be marshaled by someone who thinks that a woman cannot serve as a rabbi? Can we think of a halachic reason? Why not?
Oh, not halachic reasons or not halachic reasons?
A halachic reason.
Sneut.
I don't know. Holy
Toby, that's good. Sneut. We will talk about that later on. I'm thinking of something a little bit more specific. So, what was that?
What did Toby say?
I said, and Phyllis said Kolisha.
And Kolisha. Interesting. So, Phyllis, you know what? I don't know if you were saying that in jest or not, but in the discussion.
I'm talking about Erva.
Very good. So, Kolisha is the provision.
Blessing.
Okay, so let's just do one by one. So, Phyllis's point about Kolisha. So, the Kolisha is the prohibition for a man to listen to a woman sing. How do we get around that today? Well, the answer is many cases we don't get around them. It is problematic, but there are some leniencies such as listening to recorded, if it's in a choir mixed with men, so you're not focusing on the woman's voice. There's a whole tshuva of the Sridi Eisha deals with this, which is also slated as a future topic. So not to worry, these are things we'll deal with. But there is an opinion that a woman public speaking also violates the prohibition of kolisha. Mm-hmm. That it's not called shiras isha. It's called kolisha, the voice of a woman. So it's not limited just to singing. Otherwise, it would have used a word for singing. So okay, that's a good point. That was a point that was made to me. I remember when I was in high school and I asked that question to my rebbe. I remember in my community growing up, we had a young Israel and an aguda. So the young Israel was the modern Orthodox shul. The aguda was the Agudas Israel, the Haredi shul. The young Israel nowadays has a Lakewood rabbi. And they rebranded as Shar Shemayim. They no longer really go by Young Israel. So things have changed a little bit, much to the chagrin of some of my family and some of the old timers there, but that's another discussion. So I remember when my 10th grade Rebbe, he was the rabbi of also the Aguda in my neighborhood. He was asked to come in for a Yom Iyun to speak at Young Israel. So I remember he said that there was a woman who was supposed to speak before him. And he waited outside until she was done. And then he went in and gave his speech. And I said, well, why not? He said, well, either it's Nias, but then also Kolisha, he cited as an issue. So again, I don't know if you mentioned that tongue in cheek, Phyllis, but that is a consideration. But God willing, we'll talk about Kolisha more in depth another time, because it's an interesting thing. We don't think about it so much in the modern Orthodox community. All right. It's 8:15. So I think we got some good opinions in here. Let's see the sources. So the Sifrei on the Pasuk in Dvarim, which says, Som Tasim Alecha Melech, Som Tasim, the Sifrei comments. So this is a very, very early rabbinic source. So it says, Meis Mana Acher Tachlev. What does Som Tasim teach us? That you should appoint for yourself. It teaches us that if a king dies, you appoint another king after him. What's the word Melech, king, come to teach us? Flo Malka, to the exclusion of a queen. And then also, Achicha, what does it mean when it says your brother? Flo Me'acher, and this king has to come from among your brothers. He cannot come from outside the Jewish nation. So there's a similar idea in the United States. In order to become the president, you have to have been born as an American citizen, I believe, right? Because that's how we had the whole birthing controversy with Obama. So there's this idea also when it comes to Judaism that the king, even if he is Jewish, if he wasn't born Jewish, if he is not from a Jewish line, but if he's from converts, then that also disqualifies him from being a king. Now, what is important...
Rabbi, this does, when they're using the words brothers, it doesn't imply that it has to be hereditary.
Very good. So that's what we need source number two for. So very good. So source number two will explain this for us. But what I want to point out here in source number one is that the exclusion for a woman to serve as a monarch is the same issue with a convert serving as the monarch as well, to serve as the king. Now, this is important. Why? Because if all I did was look at this source, I would say, okay, a woman cannot serve as a queen. What does that have to do with serving as a rabbi? Those are two different professions. So all I have here is a very limited, I mean, how many people get to become president? How many people get to become king? So you tell me a woman can't serve as the king of the Jewish people, that should have no bearing for what that means for us today in the rabbinate. But what's important here is that women and converts are put in the same category. They both are excluded from the same verse. So perhaps if we understand the parameters of a convert becoming a king, or not just becoming a king, but getting any position of authority, we could also understand those parameters could be extrapolated to women as well. So let's just take a look
at the conversion. Thank God it doesn't apply to Pesach and the first Seder.
What do you mean? In what respect?
Because aren't you're not supposed to invite converts to your first Seder?
I mean, converts are welcome to come. Non-Jewish, you're not supposed to have non-Jewish guests, but that's not actually a Seder thing. That's a Yontif thing, because since one is allowed to cook on Yom Tov, but you're only the heter, the dispensation for cooking on Yom Tov was so that you could fulfill the mitzvah of eating on Yom Tov. And therefore, since only Jews are commanded in the mitzvah of Yom Tov, because it's given to the Jews, we're afraid if you invite a non-Jew over to your meal on Yom Tov, you'll come to cook for him as well. And since you're only allowed to cook for Jews on Yom Tov, you'll violate the prohibition of cooking extra food for the non-Jewish guest. But converts are welcome to come.
I thought this had to do with not being able to eat the Korban Pesach. And that's why
an Orel. Sorry, an Orel is...
Oh, but converts can, right? A convert can?
Yeah, a convert can. An Orel, someone who's uncircumcised, cannot.
Okay.
I mean, unless it's possible I'm forgetting a halacha, but that's my understanding.
What about a woman? A woman doesn't matter, right?
So let's get into why we're bringing up converts for a moment. So here's the Gemara. Ushbazichne Rav Ada Bar Hava Giura Hava. So the host of Rav Ada Bar Hava, he was a ger, he was a convert. Bahava kom and Natsi Iuv Rav Bibi. So he was, they were both running, I don't know, let's just say it was for town council. There was an open seat on town council, and they were both vying for it. Mara Marana of Dina Sarusa Damasa. One of them said, I want to have this position. Here's the key word of authority, Sarusa. Umar Amar Anav Dina Sarusa Damasa. I will want this position of authority. I want to sit on the town council of this town. So Asu Lekameh Rav Yosef, in order to settle this dispute, they came before Rav Yosef. Amar Lahu, he said, unfortunately, one of you is disqualified from serving in this position. Tanina, so he cites this Sifrei that we saw before. Som Tasim Alecha Melech Mikarev Achicha, that you have to appoint a king from your brothers. What does this pasuk teach us? Not just, look how it expands the sifrei. Before, converts just couldn't serve as kings. What he understands the sifrei to mean, what the Gemara understands, this isn't disputed. So what the Gemara understands, the Talmud understands this verse to mean, it's not just that converts are excluded from serving as kings, but what it means is the king is a paradigm for any position of authority. So what's coming to tell us is that the converts cannot serve in a position of authority over the Jewish community in general. And the same way, and here's the important point, the same way the Sifrei is expanded, not just to exclude converts from serving as kings, but from serving in any position of authority, one could make the assertion, which is assumed by many, that women also aren't just being excluded from serving as queens, but they also, the queen is a paradigm for a position of authority. So what that is conveying to the reader is that they are excluded from any position of authority over the Jewish community, just like the convert, because they're both excluded from the same source. So while there isn't a Gemara that tells us explicitly that a woman may not serve in any position of authority, it is assumed that she has the same parameters as a convert because they are derived from the same verse. They're in the same drasha. That's the idea. And so Rambam is really the one who is pointed to as being the one who's more expansive. He's the one who heralds this idea. That's the exclusion, that women may not serve as queens because it says melech lo malka, a king and not a queen. And then this next line is the important part. Rambam makes the assumption that I just made, that I just explained in the Gemara. I mean, I didn't make it. I made it because I read it in the Rambam. V'chein kol mesimo shebi Yisrael. Not just is she excluded from being a queen, but a woman is excluded from any position of authority among the Jewish people. Only a man can be appointed to such positions. So issue number one, this is the go-to source. Issue number one is basically this Sifrei and the Rambam, which assume that when women are excluded from being queens, what that's conveying is that they are excluded from serving in any position of authority, which, important to note, by the way, that isn't limited to the rabbinate. How broad do you think that could be applied? It doesn't say anything about rabbis over here. It doesn't say anything. It isn't even like a religious position. It says that they may not serve in any position. He doesn't say srara, but I think that's what he's referring to. Any position of srara, of authority. So if I were a very Haredi person and I were reading this, how far do you think I would take it? So I'll tell you how far they take it. They take it to mean that a woman serving on a shul board, on executive board, serving as a president, they would take issue with those kind of things. Now, as you can imagine, a good shulam has a different policy on these things, and we don't take the Haredi approach on this matter, but I want us to understand why we don't take that approach. So if someone is limited to the Rambam, if you're of a Maimonidean inclination, you might come and say women can't serve on the board of a shul. And by the way, if you go to a typical Agudas Yisrael, like my shul in Bayswater, less than a block away from my house, women didn't serve in any positions on any of the boards. They may have served, I think, like on a committee, because I'm sure they had something like a, I don't know if they call it a sisterhood. They might have some like Yiddish word for it. I'm not really sure, but I'm sure they had volunteer positions. But as far as the positions, the people who are around the table making the important decisions for the shul in the Haredi sphere, they don't. It's all men. It's all male dominated.
I want you to know something. I mean, look, even the Young Israel doesn't allow women presidents. And even on the OU, I sat for a number of years on the National OU Board. And I was on that board when the whole Psak Halacha thing happened. And there were raging debates, and you'd be amazed how many on that board were shocked when I told them that Agudas Shalom at that point had already had three female presidents. They were like, what? Is that an OU shul? What? So it's not just the Haredim.
That's right. That's a good point. So right, Young Israel has it in its constitution. Mm-hmm. So it's a funny thing because you see that nowadays there are some Young Israels that kind of just, well, the thing politically with Young Israel is that it's lost a lot of its power, the umbrella organization. Right. So many places just keep Young Israel as a branding for branding purposes and 501c3. But you're right. Many Young Israels kind of just ignore that constitution, charter, whatever it's called. But that was the assumption. So look at us. Agudas Shalom has been leading the way for many years at this point.
Oh, in so many ways.
All right. So That's the first issue. There are going to be four issues, by the way. So we'll do two now. I'll do two at the end. That's the main issue. The second issue, which I just want to bring up in passing, but important to be aware of, some like to cite this tshuva of the Rama. Grandma is talking about, it's a little bit obscure. He's talking about who could qualify for smicha. He's not talking about women, but he brings an idea. He writes, we don't give half smichas. We give smicha to people who are able to have smicha should the temple have been around. It's a Talmudic concept. I won't get into it now. But the idea that this Rama is cited for, some make the argument, is that smicha doesn't really exist today, by the way. What I got when I went to YU is a rabbinic certification. They call it smicha. What smicha used to mean back then was when we had a Sanhedrin and we had a court, smicha meant that you could serve on that court. You could give malchus to somebody. You could give someone lashes. It was very important. It had halachic implications. What we do nowadays when we get smicha, it's a rabbinical degree. It just means that there are some knowledgeable rabbis out there certifying that Moshe Kurtz passed a number of tests and he quasi knows a few halachos more than the average guy on the street. That's basically what smicha is. And I took some public speaking courses. So there you go. That's basically what smicha means nowadays. So that actually, by the way, compounds the question, which is, so some argue, even though smicha is not what it was back then, there's no halachic difference whether a person has smicha or not. There's no halachic nafgamina. Still, we could only call people rabbi. We can only treat people with smicha today if had the temple been around, and we still had the mesorah for smicha, the tradition for smicha, that they would have been capable of receiving it. So since if the Beis Hamikdash was around, a woman is not able to serve as a judge, as we'll soon see that debate. She would not be able to sit on the Sanhedrin, on the court. So she shouldn't receive smicha today because smicha nowadays should be modeled after what it was in yesteryear. That's the argument that they make. Now the interesting,
Yes, Rabbi, yes. You just mentioned judge, and before you mentioned that, I was going to ask you what they have to say about Dvorah. Wasn't she a judge?
Very good. So, Phyllis, you see where I'm highlighting on the, can you see the screen?
Yep.
All right, look what I'm highlighting.
On the top? Where?
On the bottom, number six.
On the bottom.
I see. Okay.
There we go. So, very good. So, Phyllis, I'm sorry,
I promise I didn't see it.
I pay Phyllis to always ask the questions when we need to move things along. So we were in cahoots over here.
Listen, there are many other women in Tanakh that are, note. There are our Shlosha Imahot,
So, Phyllis, I want to take your question and just let's take your question and unpack it. So Phyllis is pointing out something that not only did we notice here at the end of 2020, but it's something that the Rishonim, that the medieval scholars were already bothered by, which is, maybe if you're a yeshiva guy like me who like learn Gemara all day, you kind of forget that there's something called Tanakh. But the Rishonim, they made sure that they went through all of Tanakh. And they went through all of Gemara after that. So they knew what they were talking about. And while they were going through Nach on a Matzei Shabbos, they noticed that, wait a minute, there's this woman called Devorah. This woman, Deborah, who was a shofetes. She was a judge in the book of Shoftim. And being a judge, really one could understand it just meant you were a vigilante. But if you take a rabbinic anachronistic approach, a shofet also meant back then that you were judging Jewish law. So the question is, when we look in Tanakh, I mean, maybe the key is you just don't look at Nach, but if you do and you don't close your eyes, you see that there's a woman named Devorah who Chazal actually tell us people would go. She would, sit under the tree. People wouldn't see her. And she'd give shir and people would come and learn Torah with her. So the question is, wait a minute, this isn't like a new issue. So if Devorah was able to serve as a judge, why do we see in the Talmud and the Rishonim that they take issue with a woman serving as a judge? So that's an important question. But just Phyllis, you're bringing up the Imahos. The Imahos I can easily answer. The Imahos were just Rebbetzins. You know, Sarah was making the challah in the tent. And then when Rivka came, she brought the light back into the tent. Like, the Imos are easily classified as Rebbitzins. Yeah. But Devorah does not have the persona of a Rebbitzin, right? Devorah is out there. She's leading the people. She's outside the whole time. She's out there. She's a leader. Both are great. But Devorah is really looked at as the paradigm for this woman who, I guess what you would say, breaks those paradigms. So let's see. Is the question clear about Devorah? We're vaguely familiar with Devorah. We know enough about Devorah. Okay.
I don't know that much about what you, I mean, teaching, nobody's ever questioned that women can teach. But well, did she make decisions? Did she render punishment? Did she do the things that...
Ah, very good. So Toby wants us to unpack another detail. What do we mean when we say, you know, she was a shofetes, that she was this leader? I mean, did she teach like a high school class in Mayanot, or was she like the rabbi of an Aguda Sholem back then, right? We want to be anachronistic. You know, what kind of position did she occupy back then? So that's what the Rishonim are going to do. Some of the Rishonim are going to try to make a distinction as to what she was doing. You know, was she giving psak? Was she a posek living in Bnei Brak and people came and they said, Rebbe, I don't know, should I marry this person? Should I make that business deal? Or was she just like a community educator? So Sefer HaChinuch brings up this idea. And he actually, by the way, for the record, he cites a minority opinion that women can serve as dayanim, that women can serve as judges, which is very puzzling. But he says, look, yeah, in Hachinami, the pashas is that a woman is, just like Devorah was able to serve as a judge, other women who are capable may serve as judges as well. But the issue is as follows. We have a principle in Sanhedrin, D'chol she'ino kasher lahayid, eino kasher ladin, that whoever is not a kosher witness certainly is not a kosher judge. So we talked about this in my Wednesday night Hanukkah class about people who get disqualified from serving as witnesses in court because they gamble and possibly playing dreidel maybe disqualifies you, or Dungeons and Dragons. That was a Wednesday night discussion for those who were there. So let me ask you something. If someone gambles and therefore is disqualified from serving as a witness in a Jewish court, would you have a havamina? Would you think that he can now serve as a judge in that court? If you can't serve as a witness, you can't serve as a judge. Logic dictates that. Kal v'chomer. So the issue is, indisputably, women cannot serve as witnesses in a typical court proceeding in Jewish law. So one has an uphill battle to make to say they can't serve as witnesses, but they can serve as judges. That's a little difficult to understand. But it's on the record. There is a minority opinion that says that.
And the reason they say the reason they can't serve as witnesses is,
well, that's a separate shear. But do you want the sugar coated answer, or do you want what's probably the answer?
Probably.
Okay. The sugar coated answer, I'll just tell you, is women are like kings in the same way a king can't be subpoenaed. A woman can't be subpoenaed. Rasav Achik says that. I think it's nice. What's probably true is probably less something that appeals to people with 21st century sensibilities, but is that they just didn't, they thought that women wouldn't be able to handle the difficulties of a court proceeding and wouldn't be able to make good judgment as much as a man would be able to. Now, wouldn't I know we have women who are lawyers. What are you talking about? So, yeah, we can discuss.
Wouldn't be able to see the new moon either.
What was that?
Wouldn't be reliable to declare that they see the new moon?
It's a general principle. I mean, it's a low plug. So once they got disqualified from serving as witnesses in cases that require more judgment involved, more discretion, I think they were disqualified from other cases. But that really puts us more into Tamei Hamitzos category. The halacha is that they can't serve as witnesses. And so therefore, the halacha ought to be that they can't serve as judges once that's accepted. That's the point being made. But what I want to point out over here at the end of the Sefer HaChinuch, he writes, "Vanirat v'rama min asfara she'einan b'toras din." Ah, maybe it's possible that when Devorah was teaching Torah, she wasn't serving as literally a judge. She wasn't rendering psak halacha, but she was teaching Torah. I'll give you an example. There's a difference between psak and being what we call marim makom. So let's say someone comes over to me in Rosh Chodesh, Shacharis, and says, "Hey, Rabbi Kurtz, I forgot to say Yal V'Yavod. They have to repeat Shemona Esrei." And I say, "Yes, you have to repeat Shemona Esrei if you forget to say Yal V'Yavod." I didn't paskin for them. I was called what's called mar makom. I basically pointed out a halacha that's already on the books to them. I brought it to their attention. Psak is we have a new metzias. We have something new in front of us, new data, and a posting has to assess that data and decide what the din is. So you have IVF cases. That's something that's new nowadays. That's a recent a medical ability that we have. So a posting taking a position on how artificial insemination ought to work with the issues of znus, mamzerus, that's called psak because there's an aspect of innovation that is required. There's something new on the table. But for me to say the Shulchan Aruch says, repeat Yal V'Yavo if you forgot Shmoneh Esrei, I'm not paskening. I'm just informing you about what the Shulchan Aruch says. I'm not saying anything new. So it's possible that there's a distinction here. That Devorah, she wasn't giving a din. She wasn't giving a psak, but she taught Torah. That is not problematic. Toby, it looked like you were going to say something.
Yeah, I was going to say, so how do we, you know, so how do we reconcile, even in the pretty traditional Orthodox world, the concept of the Oetzet Halacha?
Ah, very
good.
Women
are coming to her with concrete issues, you know, and asking, is this okay? Is this not okay? It's not just citing a law, it's applying it. I mean, that's the difference between psak halacha and just talking, you know, teaching a class. It's applying the law in a particular case.
Women,
so how
men.
Do we allow that?
Excellent.
But they're women, not men.
Well, yes.
But it doesn't matter. They still have, the issue is the woman who's making the decision.
Very good. So two points to that. I like that you're bringing up the Yoetzet Halacha. So you guys are all a few steps ahead of me, but I'll address it now. So the Yoetzet Halacha. So for those who aren't familiar, we even have a Yoetzet in the community, Yoetzet Dina Block. And right. The role of the Yoetzet Halacha, as I understand it, is that there's the laws of Nida, which is, you know, it's pretty private. It's menstrual, marital laws. And women, rightfully so, aren't comfortable going to the rabbi in the community and discussing these intimate details with someone else's husband. And that's very fair. So what they did was, what happens is that many women either they become very machmir because they don't ask the rabbi questions because they're uncomfortable. They'll be very strict, stricter than they need to be. Or many women won't ask a question at all and they'll assume what they're doing is okay, where in fact it's not okay. So it's on both extremes. So the idea of a Yoetzet Halacha, first and foremost, was that women can ask women, intimate women's questions. And that way, and the woman, the Yoetzet Halacha, is able to advise them on the laws of Nida. Now, it happens to be many Yoetzot, they take the role also of doing, you know, women's teas and social programming, and that expands beyond it. But similar to a rabbi, when you think about it, a rabbi, first and foremost, is supposed to be dealing with religion, but also, you'll see from time to time, I'm also involved in social programming. So it works the same way. So a Yoetzet Halacha, let's just translate. Does anyone know what Yoetzet means?
An advisor.
Ah, very good, Phyllis. So even in the name, they were very careful not to call her a Poseket Halacha. She's a Yoetzet Halacha. She advises. And actually, the way at least the model is supposed to work is that the Yoetzet, when she has difficult questions or something that is considered more psak related, she's actually supposed to consult a posek. She's not supposed to make new decisions on her own. So apparently the understanding is checking a bedika cloth to determine if the type of blood on there is nida blood, if it's tameh or it's tahora. That's not considered psak. It's interesting though. Some might argue that it is.
Why not?
That's a good question, Toby. I think people who argue against the institution of Yoetzet Halacha actually make that point. So, you know, so Toby, you could join Rabbi Neuberger, you could join Rabbi Willing, you could
join.
Not
my intention. but you know, but I'm always bothered by inconsistency. So
I'm with you on that as well. It's It's the challenge always of modern Orthodoxy and being in the middle and trying to reconcile all these things. That's always the question. Are we nuanced or are we inconsistent? That's always the question. Okay. So, but before, you know, let's just backtrack a little bit. I want to provide a few more answers for Devora in case you weren't satisfied with the first one. Toso says, Devora is simply just an exception to the rule. Why? Amahavi Raya de Isha.
Can't hear you. You're
what?
Okay.
Can't hear me?
The sound went off for a second.
Okay, sound back on. We're good?
Yes, now it's okay.
Okay, I guess when I raised my voice, that's when it went off. Ein lahavi raya de isha kishera. Don't derive from Devora. Don't look to her as a model. Devora is the exception that proves the rule. The shema ha'i mekabu nosa aleya mishum shechina. Why? Because Devora was a prophetess. And the shechina, the divine presence, rested upon her. So if God chose her to be an emissary of him in this world, then if God says it's okay, it's okay. You know what it's almost like? Lahavdil. I'm not sure if Lahavdil is one way or the other. It goes both ways, I guess. So it's like the same question. How could God command us to put the Kruvim, the cherubs, if that's how you pronounce it, on the Ark of the Covenant? We're not allowed to make a pestle. We're not allowed to make an engravement, a bust. We're not allowed to make those kind of things. That's idolatrous. So why were we allowed to make the angels, the cherubs, on the Ark of the Covenant? The answer is because God said we could, then it's permissible. So there's almost that kind of thinking over here that a woman would not be able to serve as a judge, but because God said so, that's the exception that proves the rule. We don't look at the cherubim and say, so we're able to carve those angels out. Now we can make other sculptures. No, that's the exception that proves the rule. That's the idea Tosis behind Devora. So Devora actually does the opposite. She accomplishes the opposite. She shows that in general, women are not supposed to be like Devora, which is funny because we always turned her as the role model. I'm sure there's a number of women's programs that have Devora as like in the name somewhere. Usually it's Bruria, actually. But Bruria had like a darker ending, but that's for another time. Okay. So one other answer that's given that I want to look at is in the Ramban. The Ramban says the issue with someone judging you is maybe women can't serve as kosher judges. But again, you know, Toby and any other lawyers who are with us in the room, there's something called, I think, an arbitration court where you don't want to go through the court system. So when you get into a deal with somebody, you put an arbitration clause in there, which says that if we ever have a dispute, instead of us going and dragging through the court system, we'll have it resolved more smoothly with the American Arbitration Association. America, AAA. Huh. That's also AAA. Occurred to me. So you have the, Devora was not a judge de jure. She was a judge who was accepted upon them for arbitration. They said she has good judgment. She has good discretion. She's very level-headed. We trust her to do arbitration for us, but she's not a formal judge. But we accept her upon us anyway, because if you and I have a monetary dispute, we can choose who to go to resolve that if we want to. And that actually, by the way, remember how we talked about how the laws of a convert serving as a rabbi might be very similar to the laws and dispensations for a woman serving a position of authority as a rabbi. So that actually is an idea that comes up in the Shach. The Shach says that a convert, the Shulchan Aruch says a convert can't serve as a rabbi based on the Gemara that we saw earlier in source 2. I will im mekabu olav ladin mutter, but he cites the Rush who says that if they accept the convert upon themselves to do arbitration, then that is okay. So it's the same parameters here. If one accepts the convert to be a judge, he may judge. If one accepts a woman upon them, then that is okay. So what's interesting is if that really is what it comes down to, what does that mean for the rabbinate? Assuming, I think it's fair that we could use judges as something similar, close enough to what it is to be a rabbi. Let's put it this way. If someone's kosher to be a judge, on a Jewish court, you're kosher to be a rabbi as well, because you kind of have to be a rabbi to be on the court, right? You need smicha to be on it. So if a woman is able to serve as a judge, assuming both sides agree to it, what if both sides, or what if a community decides that they are okay with a woman serving as a rabbi? They're okay with a convert serving as the rabbi. By the way, I need to check this. Don't hold me to it. But I believe YU gives smicha to gerim, to people who convert. So symposium. You know, you need a fancy title always. A symposium on progressive halacha. Don't ask me what that means. But there's a symposium on progressive halacha, which basically got everyone from like Reform Judaism, Conservative Judaism, Hadar Judaism, and then they brought in Rav Ezra Schwartz and Yoetzet Halacha, kind of just to, you know, talk about women in the in Orthodoxy. So during Q&A, Rabbi Michael J. Broyd, he asked that question. I was watching it live. I remember I was off the day it took place. Marissa and I were eating breakfast together. It must have been a holiday or something. We're watching it. And, you know, it was entertaining. It was a good way to waste some time. And so Rabbi Broyd asked the panel, he said, actually to Rabbi Schwartz, he said, I don't get it. Converts and women are practically in the same category as we have seen at this point. I hope I've demonstrated that clearly. They both are ostensibly prohibited from serving as rabbis from the same pasuk, but that means they also have the same dispensation. So why is it acceptable in normative Judaism for a convert to get smicha today, but not for a woman to get smicha today? Because if you are right, Toby, you said, I don't care what side you take, but I want you to be consistent. So right. If you are going to say women get... Okay, well, Kol Isha, we'll get to that in a moment. We'll get to the tzniyah stuff in a moment. But assuming srara, authority, is the issue, if a convert can be a rabbi, why can't a woman be a rabbi? So it's very hard to make that distinction unless you turn to the point that Phyllis is bringing up again, that others have brought up, which is issues of kolisha, issues of tznius, that we'll look at in just one moment. But I wanted to bring one more source to our attention, which I'd be remiss if we didn't look at it at least briefly. Rav Moshe Feinstein had to deal with this question, not about women being rabbis, but I remember I was doing my shkiach work in Plainview at the shop right there. And the person who trained me for the mashgiach job was a woman who lived in the community. So I was like, wait, women can serve as mashgiachs? Like, that didn't occur to me. Because, you know, like, you always think of, like, the rabbi with the scraggly beard coming in and checking everything out and then leaving. That's always my vision of the mashgiach. So it was surprising to me. Well, actually, the Kafke, which runs the kashrus there, they are okay with it. Why? Because Rav Moshe Feinstein had a tshuva. The question was that there was a man and wife. They were both served as mashgichim, and the husband unfortunately passed away. And the wife, her only way of making parnasa now was to take over the mashgiach position that her husband had. That was her way to make parnasa. The issue is that if you're a mashgiach, it's a position of authority, because you're basically determining, is this establishment a kosher establishment or not? So the question is, how could a woman serve in a position of mashgiach? That's the same issue as serving as a rabbi. It's a position of authority. By the way, one quick quip. It's interesting because just going back, this just occurred to me. It didn't just occur to me now, but I wanted to bring it up. Speaking of consistency, it's almost lishing tussum, because in the Haredi community, the rabbi of the synagogue tends to have ultimate power. That's usually how it works in many Haredi synagogues. So maybe the Haredim are actually being consistent, because in a Haredi synagogue where the rabbi is not really beholden to all these different clauses and committees and such, so he has ultimate power, so that's where a woman can't serve, because that's actually srara. But in a more modern progressive synagogue where the rabbi isn't the only voice at the table and he isn't, you know, always ruling with an iron fist, he's actually beholden to the members of the community. So it's less a position of srara. It's less a position of authority. Now, why am I bringing that up now? Because if you look at the Igros Moshe, he says, why is it permissible for a woman to serve as a mashgiach? Because if you work for a kashrus agency, when I was working as a mashgiach at ShopRite, I wasn't really the guy who determined whether the place was kosher or not. The kafkei determines whether to pull the hashgacha or whether to keep a hashgacha on the place. I'm just simply their underling. I'm their shliach. I still have to answer to the rabbi at the kafkei. Similarly, over here, he says, she tiyas chur meharav, shirak harav ye bailim shala. The manager of the hashgacha organization, her boss, he ultimately calls the shots. And when you think about it, when someone serves a mashkiach, it depends on the business model, really. But really, you're supposed to be paid by the hashgacha, by the kashrus agency. That's not really always how it worked. I got paid by ShopRite right away, but that's another discussion. But the point he's making is that mashkiach is different from the rabbi because a mashkiach answers to somebody else. Now, again, going back to our distinction between maybe more Haredi versus modern Orthodox synagogue model. In a Haredi community, the rabbi really, you know, he could say, I mean, it doesn't always work that way, but more times than not, he could basically say what he wants and there won't be repercussions. People will listen. It's Das Torah. But in a modern Orthodox community, that's not how it works. So there is less authority in that. And perhaps, actually, ironically, we could apply Rav Moshe's leniency to the modern Orthodox community as well. Because if a woman were to become a rabbi in the modern Orthodox community, she would still be beholden to the executive board. She'd be beholden to the president. She'd be beholden to the various board members of the shul. So actually, one could argue that she's not in a position of absolute authority. In fact, by the way, that argument is the exact argument why a woman can serve as a president of a shul. Because a woman who serves as president, even though, you know, she is very significant, of course, I'll put in all the compliments right over here, insert all those things. Okay. We're short on time, unfortunately. But ultimately, again, I'm still learning how all the shul politics and dynamics work, but anyone who serves as a president is still beholden to other members of the shul. They don't have absolute authority. So that argument was made to permit a woman to serve as a president. Now, let me ask you the question. If that argument can be made for a woman to serve as a president against the National Council of the Young Israel, is it a far cry to make that argument for a woman to serve as a rabbi of a shul as well? I'll let us think about that. We only have 5 minutes left, but think about that. Think about whether that's really a far cry or whether that's an artificial distinction that we're making. But then there are two other considerations that we need to take into account, which Toby, Phyllis, and perhaps Anne and others, I think, raised, which is two things. Number one, there's the issue of modesty, the issue of tznius. So I many people say this, by the way, but I specifically put Rav Cook on the source sheet because many times in the modern Orthodox community, because we are religious Zionism is part of our philosophy, we look to Rav Cook as a role model of rabbinic guidance because, you know, who was a bigger religious Zionist than Rav Cook, right? So this is coming from Rav Cook. I just want to just appreciate this. Maybe after this, we won't look to him as a model of modern orthodoxy. Regarding women serving in positions of government authority, I have nothing to add to that which all the rabbis said before me. B'Torah, b'Neviim, u'b'Ksuvim, in Tanakh, b'Halacha u'b'Agada, through the entire vast corpus of rabbinic and biblical literature. There is but one voice, one opinion that issues forth. Shechovas ovodos hatzibur kavumu telasi al hagvarim, that the role of serving in a position of authority over the tzibur, over the community, lies in the hands of men. Sha'ish darcho lechavish, for the way of man is to conquer. Ve'ena isha darcho lechavish, and it's not the way of women to conquer. U'shetafkidim shel misra shel mishva shel edus, and a position of judgment, the position of serving as witnesses, inam shayachim la, they are not relevant for her. V'chol kvodahi panima, rather, as the rabbis say, this is a Gemara, kol kvodah basnach panima, it's the rallying cry of Beis Yaakov's, that the honor of a woman is found when she is inside the home or inside the palace. And he says also the issue is that it leads to men and women fraternizing with each other, which also is problematic. And so he says that women out of tzniut are not supposed to be serving in positions of authority. Not as something inherently wrong with their judgment, but that it is only appropriate for men to be in the public sphere. Now, again, this position is not a chiddush to anyone, but I just want you to know that Rav Kook espoused this position. So just so you could put him on there for the record. Now, some of us are like, okay, I never really thought of Rav Kook as a model for modern orthodoxy anyway. Well, many, many do. So for those who do, you can take that into account. But then I want to bring in everyone's favorite source right here at the end with only a few minutes. The Orthodox Union response, it's called the response of the rabbinic panel. A very innocuous name. But this was basically the paper that came out a few years ago where Schechter, Rav Ezer Schwartz, Rav Rosenzweig, a number of other YU, OU, Rabbanim got together. They said, women may not serve as rabbis, but women may serve as yoatzot if the community deems it appropriate. And women should therefore also be serving as in community educational positions, and they're encouraged to learn Torah as they wish, something like that. There was a lot of, It was verbose. Let's go with that. It was verbose. And let me show you what I mean by verbose, to the point that it almost obfuscates the matter. Gender differences have historically been particularly evident in the arena of public service. For those who are with us for Leaves of Faith, this is what it's going to say. This is what it sounds like. We believe that these distinctions are not merely a relic of times bygone. Instead, they reflect a Torah ethos, a Mesorah of different avenues and emphases by which men and women are to achieve identical goals, the service of God and the perpetuation of the Jewish people. It is the majority opinion of our panel that the appointment of women to clergy positions would be a contradiction to this halachic ethos, i.e., of gender norms. And so the final point, while I think, you know, it was a little bit too verbose and it took me too long to read through just to get to that conclusion, that's all they really need to say. The argument that they make is that gender roles are not a mistake. It's not just something that was limited to the biblical era, the Talmudic era, but gender roles are actually an inherent part of halakha, are inherently built into Jewish philosophy. Now, where does one draw the line between those gender roles and what is only for men, only for women, and what can be unisex, what can be both? That's where a lot of the discussion takes place. But they see a woman assuming the role of the rabbi as breaking the norms that are set forth by the Torah. And this is really deserving of a broader discussion, which is feminism, Judaism, do they go together? Can they be reconciled? Are they opposed to each other? That will be a shiur, God willing, we'll do in the future, a shiur from Rav Moshe Feinstein. But that ultimately was what led the OU to say was problematic. The OU brought in the source that we mentioned and much more about the Rambam and a woman not serving as a queen, therefore she can't serve as a rabbi either. They brought that in. But after I read that whole paper, I think that really is what sums it up, is that the belief was that it goes against the ethos of Torah Judaism, and that's ultimately what led them to say it. Now, they may have derived those ethos from that pasuk, from that rabbinic derivation and injunction, but ultimately, I'll just give my opinion. I think if one wants to be matir, if one wants to halachically permit a woman to serve as a rabbi in a community, it shouldn't be that much harder. There's reasons we saw, but it shouldn't be that much harder than enabling a convert to serve as a rabbi in the community. So what I think it comes down to, and honestly, except for a few people in the middle, I think basically the ideologues on both sides would actually agree that it's more a matter of hashkafa than it is a matter of halacha. But by the way, just because something's hashkafic doesn't mean it's insignificant. We have an idea of kadosh and tiyu. Just because something's not written explicitly in halacha doesn't mean that it's okay to do something. Now, I'm not the arbiter of deciding what is hashkafi okay, what is not hashkafi okay. That's why they got these rabbis together to decide that. So anyway, I'm not taking any policy decisions. I'm not taking any final decisions on the matter, but the sources are there. I hope I outlined them clearly enough so we understand the different considerations. There is so much written on this topic that it would take us hours upon hours to go through all of it. There, I think, is like a 90-page booklet put out that they gave to us in Smicha about it. But God willing, I could always forward that to you. I hope I summarize the topic sufficiently just so we can appreciate the sources behind the discussion. And hopefully, even if we take one side ultimately and we have an opinion, we can at least understand the basis for the other side as well. And that's really the goal of this series in general. Okay?
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you. All right. Yasher Kalef,
everybody. What problem?
Very good discussion.
Okay. Well, I guess it's after 9 o'clock, so we're all too tired for a discussion.
I wonder what they say about the fact that Dvora, it says Vatashar Dvora, she sang. And Miriam told the women to sing, you know. So they break the rules when they want to.
The Kolisha class.
They break the rules when they want to. That's why
Rabbi almost.
They find
Audrey, I'm trying to read what Audrey's putting up over there. Can anyone read that? Rabbi Avi Weiss almost excommunicated. Okay, I got it. I read it.
Ain't
Achinami. So, you know, we are blessed to have a diverse community here where different people will take different stances on this issue. And look, I just hope that I provided Torah sources that instead of making this a political discussion, it could be one that's rooted in Torah sources and we can talk about it more intelligently and maybe hopefully, you know, be able to listen to the other side because we understand there are sources that could go either way. All right.
Thank you so much.
Yasher Kalef.
Good night, everyone.
Good night, everybody.